One individual finally got rid of a certain photograph because it was taken long ago, and every time they looked at it, they felt older. Now this, of course, is probably time for that picture to go. But it didn't have to go for that reason. What was its moral value? Could it have meant something had it been approached differently? Could it have helped this individual to bridge an interval in his own consciousness? Could he have considered this picture representing his own youthfulness, and in so doing also considered how much he had grown since then, how much more mature he was in understanding? If this picture, therefore, conveyed the image of a self outgrown, it could still be a very interesting problem in moral value. It could give him something. But if he has simply grown older without growing any better, then this picture becomes a kind of a perpetual reminder of a wasted lifetime, and the quicker it has gone, the better. But this is because of the person, not because of the object. Now we also realize that in these kind of things, there is another sort of discrimination possible. But this comes a little further along, and we can't expect everyone to immediately make use of it. But one of the Oriental concepts in these matters is that we shouldn't keep anything ourselves that won't be valuable to someone else after we're gone. That'll thin us down and do it quickly. This will get rid of innumerable things which have been fire hazards for years. In other words, supposing this particular collection was passed on to a perfect stranger, what would it be worth? Yet if it has value, it will always have value. Well, we'll say, after all, we can't expect a perfect stranger to remember our Aunt Hattie the way we do. And that picture is a very good likeness of her, and she has many associations that are of interest to us. That's all right. If that is a means of bringing some positive reaction to ourselves, then in that picture there is kihin, moral value. If we remember her in a way that would cause us to be a better person, then there is value there. But that value is probably for ourselves alone, unless in that face there is a value even for a perfect stranger, and it can happen. There are things which are very personal, and yet, in a strange way, can make the whole world better. And there are other things that are very personal that are not even making us any better. But as we go further along in the realm of artistry, we have an inclination to recognize the universality of value. That which will really help us, usually will really help other people. And these things, which are merely very personal memories, often mingled with regrets, sometimes, although there is a certain nostalgia in them, they're not doing us any real good. There are things which are binding us to old patterns, refusing to let us outgrow certain reminiscences and certain associations, and we might be better to do what the American Indian did every so often, tear up everything and start over. Because these things do not always serve us as catalyzing agencies for good. Very often they tie us to something. I remember one individual who was miserable all their lives because in middle life they lost most of their worldly goods and had very little to show for it except a photograph of the ancestral home. Every time they looked at the picture, they burst into tears. They were never able to get over the fact that they had once lived there. This picture should be immediately relegated to the historical society or something of that nature, which appreciates fine old colonial homes, because it's doing that person no good. So if you have things around you, the associations of which are not making you stronger, then these things have no great value. They have no kihin. They do not make you face life with greater courage. Now you may have so many things mixed around in a situation of this nature that instead of working for you or against you, they simply confuse you. You are surrounded by meaningless things. Things that perhaps might have meaning to someone else, might have had meaning to you at one time, but things which have ceased to have meaning. Now you can sit down very quietly with these things and say to yourself, have I exhausted their meaning? Have I overlooked a great deal? Is there meaning here that I don't remember, haven't thought about, haven't recognized? Is there some reason why I did keep these things, even though they have gradually become comparatively unconsidered? If you can't rescue meaning from these things, then they are cluttering life. Then they are confusing. They're carrying into the psychological nature of the person a certain untidiness. And one of the great secrets of moral value is this tidiness of things. Either what you have should serve you, serve someone else, or be respectfully and reluctantly, as the Japanese do, buried with military honors. In Japan, for instance, when a well-known and well-loved and well-used article is either no longer good because it is worn out, or no longer valuable because of its associations, no one would think of destroying it in the common sense of dumping it into the nearest garbage can. What would be done with it would be to take it quietly to a beautiful place in the forest, dig it a little grave, bury it, and say a prayer over it. Because after all, at one time or other, it was a faithful friend, a useful help in some emergency. It was meaningful to someone. And in those countries in old days, they never even threw away a newspaper. Because a newspaper had at least given them a message that might be important to them and was entitled to dignified burial. Well, we may laugh at the idea of the dignified burial, but consider the number of corpses that we leave above ground as far as these things are concerned. At least these people had the good taste to bury their dead. We try to live with it, and we find it very demoralizing. So we begin to gradually sort things towards simplicity. Now, as we gradually get rid of things that are not particularly valuable, we begin to reduce ostentation or to reduce confusion. And gradually, as the things that are not very meaningful begin to disappear, what's left becomes more and more significant. Sometimes more and more of a problem. Because it's quite possible that when we live in confusion, we don't notice how bad a chair looks. But when it stands all by itself, we can say, how have I lived with it this long? If we have the curtains in the room all pinned up with pictures of our relatives, we don't notice that the curtains themselves are in rather bad taste. We take off the pictures, we wonder how we can continue to live with the curtains. This is an experience that we have. So little by little, that which is not good for us becomes apparently not good for us. We sense it. We know it. Whereas previously, by confusion, we were able to ignore the entire issue. But we can never ignore the psychological effect of these things upon ourselves. Nor can we ever ignore the psychological effect of confusion upon the integration of our own personality. So little by little, we reduce these things until we come to a more or less stark simplicity. When we begin to do this, something else begins to happen. After we remove all of these knickknacks and this cluttering, and this can be an internal process in our own minds just as easily as it can be a process in a house or an apartment, as we begin to get rid of the bric-a-brackery, so to say, we begin to find that simplicity may be hard to live with. One of the reasons why simplicity is hard to live with is because it demands more from us. The simple life must be a more valuable life, or it is simply a bare life. Here we come face to face with a reality. If the room is empty, because we have thrown away all the junk, then we are forced to live in an empty room. Now, there's nothing more tragic than an empty person in an empty room. This is compound emptiness, and it's most trying. Under those conditions, our first thought probably would be to go to the nearest auction and fill up again, because the very presence of this emptiness is a burden on our spirit. We can't associate emptiness with cleanliness. That is, cleanliness not of dirt, but cleanliness of accumulation. But after we begin to simplify the situation, things begin to happen to us. One of the things that happens to us is that we begin to feel certain needs for things that are essential or valuable. We've gotten rid of those grand old chromo portraits and lithographic, we'll say, landscapes that once ornamented our walls. They were pretty bad to start with. We didn't mind them as long as they were mixed in with a thousand other things. But when they were all by themselves, we couldn't stand them any longer. So we got rid of them. Now we have empty walls. Well, most people are not quite ready for the entirely empty wall yet. That is an asceticism that gradually changes a home into a monastery. And that is not the idea. But now we begin to think in terms of what would we want to put on that wall. What now would make this place, this house we live in, warmer and better and closer to an expression of ourselves? In olden times, it was very hard for Western man to get self-expression because he inherited too much. He got all the family heirlooms, and he was a traitor if he destroyed one of them. He kept them carefully to pass on to his descendants, and by the third generation, someone had the courage to throw them out, but not him. Today, we don't do this so much anymore. Vast accumulations are not very practical. We live less and less permanently and in smaller space. Therefore, we do not have such a tendency to preserve old things. But we do very often have those things which are too good to throw away, etc., etc., etc. But the time may come when we have to dispose of them. Perhaps someone else needs them. We do not. But we are now with a very simple, almost austere situation, and a song in our heart that needs some kind of brightness and music for its own continuance. Now we begin to choose. Now, out of greater discrimination, we decide what we really want there. And if we are wise people, it may take us 6 months or a year to decide what we're going to put on that wall. But when it is on that wall, it is going to have kihim in our lives. It is going to have moral value. We now want it because we need something in particular. We've gotten rid of the things we tolerated or the things that we lived with so indifferently we forgot we even owned them. Now the thing has meaning. Taste begins to move in ourselves. Consciousness begins to determine what we are going to have. And little by little, we make these changes until we finally have a few better things to live with. These better things do something for us. They help us in the process of expressing our own consciousness. Their simplicity becomes orderliness in our psychic integration. We are better people because we have learned to understand this betterness. Well, when the time comes, however, to suddenly start this betterness problem, we are likely to feel a little bit lost. Many, many people suddenly discover that they have no idea what kind of a picture they ought to hang on a wall. They haven't the slightest concept of a good color for the room in which they're going to live. They don't know what would be a really suitable and attractive carpet. They don't know. So they try to get some help on this subject, some advice. And there's always someone to advise them. And they will advise them what kind of carpet to put down just as quickly as they'll advise them what candidate to vote for. And the individual will be moved by the same series of weaknesses in himself. He doesn't understand. He doesn't mean not to understand, but he simply has grown up, become an educated person, perhaps a parent, success in business, a respected citizen, hasn't the slightest idea what color carpet he likes best. He just doesn't know. So he goes down where there are 500 samples and he's worse off than he was before. He just doesn't know. The only answer in Zen for this situation is to sit on the bare floor until you find out yourself. Decide what you want. If you find something and you think you like it and you put it down and you immediately hate it, that is Zen. Get rid of it and start over. Educate yourself. Because what you are doing when you say you're educating yourself is really you are expressing something of your own inner life. Now, it is naturally desirable and helpful for the person who is going to do something about the Zen attitude to have some little understanding of the subject. He can't always immediately step from a chaos of confused values to an admirable power to select correct values. But fortunately for him, there are many ways in which he can learn. He can learn through good books. He can learn by going to the public library and studying not how to decorate his home, but perhaps studying Zen art. Studying what constitutes fineness. What is it that made Sesshu great? You can get reproductions of Sesshu's pictures and find out what made Sesshu great. It may be a long time before any of us will understand the full depth of this man. But we can begin to sense meaning. We can sense value. And we can gradually educate ourselves just as we would educate ourselves in bookkeeping or accounting or anything else. But most people do not sort of feel that this kind of education is necessary. But this is the most important kind of education, because it is that form which gives us peace of soul. It is this which gives us health, moral, emotional, mental health. It gives us significance in life. It lifts us into the understanding of things which are right. And this understanding is a terribly important thing to have. And in the rush and haste and jumble of our present way of life, we don't think about these things. And as a result, we're sick all the time. And life goes badly for us, and our homes break up, and our children are disobedient. These things happen because of something. They're not merely accidents happening to the best of people in spite of themselves. They are happening to people who in some way have not been able to integrate their values sufficiently, that haven't been able to solve this important and subtle situation. So, little by little, by taking a profound interest in something, the individual gradually discovers what is good. Now, the final proof of what is good, within a range of what can be good, is the simple expression of consciousness. This I like. This is for me. I don't know why, but this is for me. This means something. This gives something to my consciousness. And the simplest childlike acceptance of this is a simple statement, I like it. And if this is uninfluenced by other people, if this is uninfluenced by price, if this is uninfluenced by fashion or the modes of the day, but arises from the deepest part of our own understanding, when we say, I like it, that means that it is right for us at that particular time. Now, perhaps 5, 10, 20 years from now, we may not like it so well. We shouldn't. Unless we have been far wiser than we realized, we should outgrow that which we like, but not immediately. And as we outgrow it, we will instinctively replace it if we do not allow some false values to cause us to hold on to it. Thus, the final power of Zen is the simple, direct statement of this I like. This, it gives expression to consciousness. If we catch ourselves liking the wrong kind of things long enough, we will begin to doubt our own taste, and then we'll do something about it. But the simple term of why do I like it, if you can break it down, if you can rationalize it at all, it is that it should do something good to you. It should do something to make life a little more valuable. It should open a door. Every picture on a wall should be a window into something, into some form of understanding. This doesn't mean they should all be pastoral scenes by any means, but they should be things which open doors of appreciation, that transform limitation into openness, the airiness of freedom. Everything that we have should free us, never enslave us. The only enslavement is our responsibility to God and protect that which is good. Otherwise, these things are all open doors to experiences of consciousness. You will find this type of philosophy keeps things rather simple. It saves us a lot of money in the long run because it prevents us from accumulating things which we will never really want. It gets us out of the trinket-buying class and gets us away from the toy-accumulating instinct of some children. It begins to be something valuable and something important. Now, usefulness is a value. Usefulness is a moral value. Therefore, there are many things that we have to own or possess that we need because we use them. Zen would never for a moment recommend that the individual not make proper use of those things which are necessary for him. And in our way of life, necessities reach out into fields of luxuries that our forefathers never knew. This means, perhaps, that we now include certain luxuries among necessities. If this is true, there is no effort to take them away from us. The problem, however, always is to try to reduce these things to their minimum. Always recognizing that we become servants of anything we possess that we do not use. That we become servants of things which require more care to maintain than this good which they provide. And because we are status-seeking people, and because our image is influenced by our possessions, many individuals become hopelessly overburdened in an effort to appear to be prosperous. This is not the answer to any essential value whatever. In the problems of things necessary, there is also moral value. Because these things necessary teach us. Every device and contrivance that we have is based upon a principle of some kind. This principle can be important. It can be instructive. It can be valuable. Also, all conveniences that we have are time or labor savers, at least theoretically. Consequently, they are protecting our time allotments. They are protecting our energy reserves. Therefore, in turn, they provide us with greater opportunity. Conveniences are only instruments of liberation. They are only valuable because they enable us to have more time for important activity. The individual who fills their home with every labor-saving device that they have develops by this means a considerable amount of leisure and spends this entire leisure watching television is really caught in a vicious situation. He has bought the leisure, he has paid for it. He has surrounded himself with means of labor saving, but he has no understanding, no spirit of kihin to help him to do something with the time and energy he has saved. So Zen comes in with a very important thought, namely that the automatic dishwasher is of really no value unless it frees the person to do something more important than wash dishes. Now that, it is not the purpose of the dishwasher merely to save labor. Its purpose is to free human consciousness to grow. And if the consciousness doesn't grow, the whole project is a dismal failure. I remember some years ago, a well-known family had a Japanese houseboy. This young man was a master flower arranger, and he was also a master of a number of related oriental arts. One day, the family came home and found all of the important and expensive gadgets out on the back in the backyard stacked around the trash can. It was a very bad moment for the family, and they immediately got all ready to throw the Japanese houseboy out on his ear. He blandly was asked, when they asked him why he had thrown all their best dishwashers and all their coffee makers and toasters washing machines and everything and pile them up for the garbage man to take away, he very blandly replied, he might as well, because they didn't mean anything anyway. The people had had all these things for years and still wasted all their time. So they might just as well throw them out and work, because they weren't good for anything else. Obviously, the young Japanese houseboy found new employment soon after, but he made a point which these people simply were not big enough to see. He was trying, in a fine, gentle, Zen manner, to relieve them of certain mistakes and express the facts of life. But this is a situation that nearly all Western man faces. The tremendous increase of conveniences and commodities, and the attendant rise in delinquency from the inability to use time. There is absolutely no reason why we should have all these devices if the free time is going to be spent in worry. And lots of it is. Or if, as a result of all these devices, we have 2 hours with which to gather with our neighbors and analyze how long it'll be before the first bomb falls. There's no use in having devices under such conditions. Devices, all forms of so-called conveniences, are created to help man to have more opportunity to be human, to get away from certain drudgeries which afflicted him in the past, but which, by the way, usually kept him healthy, and into a state of consciousness in which he could grow more rapidly. So our Zen concept comes in here and says that probably the heaviest responsibility we assume is that which comes as a result of buying this time and then wasting it. Kihin also tells us something about the moral value of time. It tells us how, in one way or another, we should use this important commodity. Time, even in the Zen philosophy, should be enjoyable. There's nothing in Zen that tells us that we have to spend all our spare time sitting in meditation with our eyes crossed, gazing at the point of our noses. This is not the Zen way of life. Certainly they enjoy meditation and the contemplative existence, but this is because they enjoy it and not because it is a terrible hardship wished upon them. The purpose of time in Zen is to have a certain enthusiasm about it. There's a very interesting picture among the drawings of the Japanese artist Hokusai, a series of drawings called Views of Mount Fuji. And it's a whole album of nothing but pictures of this mountain from every conceivable angle and with every conceivable property added to make it a more interesting and dynamic scene. In one of these scenes, Hokusai himself apparently has opened the shutters of a circular window in his studio, is looking out and is seeing Fuji in the group of clouds out against the horizon. The old man is sitting with his arms over his head. He is just in a state of ecstasy. He is practically reaching out, grabbing for the mountain. He has never been so happy in his life. At that moment, the light was just right, and he had this magnificent view of the mountain, and he was perfectly entranced. He was almost in an ecstasy of pleasure over this wonderful thing he was looking at. He was enjoying himself. He was not under some terrible compulsion in which he had to be good or had to see something out there. He loved it. It was his mountain. It was the thing that meant a great deal to him. The arrangement of light and cloud had made it particularly beautiful at that moment, and he was supremely happy. And Zen has this purpose of giving us a certain amount of happiness, to make us enjoy life perhaps more than we've ever enjoyed it before, because we do not destroy happiness by our own attitudes. Thus, in using time in the Zen concept, we use it to enjoy that which is good. We find the tremendous joy of things that are not even costly. We find the tremendous appreciation of the beauty in things because of the increasing availability of beauty in ourselves. Thus, Zen lives in a rather pleasant world, a world in which we are more cheerful, more contented, more optimistic than we could possibly be under the pressures with which we generally burden ourselves. One of these pressures is debt. It is very hard for modern man in the West to laugh today without a snicker. He can't have a real good old-fashioned laugh. He has to have a kind of a sour, sarcastic smirk, because we can no longer afford to laugh. Life has burdened us so that real, honest humor has lost its appeal, lost its meaning to us. We can't enjoy. We can only think of the terrible expense, morning, noon, and night. So Zen, by simplifying life, gives us back our sense of humor. It makes simple things enjoyable, valuable, and useful, and frees us from all of this artificiality with which we are constantly burdening our own lives. So Hikihin, as moral value again, gives us the ability to enjoy the allotments of beauty which belong not only to our own means, but to our universe. The same problem arises, for instance, a friend of mine not long ago was in Japan and came back and said that everything was lovely except he wished they'd paint the houses. He said there's nothing but a bunch of old bleached wood houses everywhere you turn. They look as though they needed 3 coats of paint and a good primer. But they wouldn't have it for anything in the world. When we build a house, we want it to dominate the landscape, because we think a house is about the most beautiful, important thing in the world, especially if it's ours. And the more money we can put into the house and the taller it stands, the more it overshadows the neighbors, the happier we are. We want everyone to see the house. But where Zen dominates, you don't have this problem. Therefore, you also escape from the whole problem of keeping up with the Joneses, which has been worrying us to death for the last 100 years. Actually, the Zen believer, not necessarily a monastic person, just one in whose heart the Zen doctrine is affecting his way of life to some degree, his first thought is, let's not mutilate the scenery. After all, I can't build anything that is beautiful as the tree I'm going to have to cut down to put the house there. Or if I've got a nice little glade here with some beautiful trees and some rocks in the background and a nice mountain coming up in the rear, and here is a lovely stretch of lawn and a little pool and some rocks and some iris, well, what do I want to put a house there for? All I'm going to do is mutilate this thing. Oh, it's going to be much less beautiful than it would be if I didn't put a house there, but unfortunately I have to live. Therefore, I'm going to put the house there, but it's going to be as unnoticeable as possible. It's going to retire. It's going to be hiding in those trees and not dominate them. The trees are still going to dominate. And perhaps a nice rustic little house with those trees isn't going to look so badly. It won't make the trees particularly unpleasant to look at. But no one would imagine that against this beautiful foliage, against this wonderful background, perhaps of ancient cryptomeria or something of that nature, someone is going to put a turquoise blue house with a fine white edging. This just isn't imaginable to these people. The beautiful thing is to live as close to that which is the source of beauty, which is life itself. That actually, in Zen, the universe itself is so magnificent that the duty of man is to become a kind of gardener, to take care of it, to make certain that it retains its charm, to prevent perhaps a certain wildness from overwhelming things, just to control but never to destroy, just to direct, never to frustrate. So as a result, my friend thought that all the houses needed a coat of paint, simply because it didn't occur to him that these people didn't want a coat of paint. And in speaking of that type of thing, their own little way of building is peculiarly appropriate to their country. Perhaps it wouldn't work here at all. Perhaps we are going to be the proud possessors of the mansions for a long time, and they're going to disturb the scenery, and they're going to be next to each other, and no two are going to match architecturally, and we're going to live in a mild headache as a result. That may be the way we have to do it. But it's nothing to be particularly proud of or glad about. It simply shows some way the lack of this maturity. Maturity that means a great deal when we have to face a mature way of life. We are gradually growing up as a people. And barring acts of providence, we will continue to grow up until we ultimately mature. And as we grow older, we are going to face the problems of maturity. And as we face these problems, we're going to realize that we can only face them if we are mature ourselves. The day of the perpetual adolescent is disappearing. The responsibilities of existence are growing heavier every day. The average individual is not making the necessary adjustments to accept a new way of life that is coming upon us and is inevitably here to stay. In order to meet this new way of life without shock, without stress, without pain, without tragedy, we must move ourselves. We must adjust to something more mature. Well, what is there more mature than man that he can adjust to? The Zen monk says there's one thing always more mature than man that he must adjust to, and that is his universe. Actually, survival is adjustment. It is acceptance. It is the individual fitting his own personal ambitions and purposes into a universal pattern that is mature and is continuing. Human styles come and go. Human periods of history will come and go. But nature goes on. The universe goes on. And man has his greatest probability of survival by adjusting himself to these large universal patterns. These universal patterns are not broken by tiny fragments of ambition, as human patterns are. They're not measured from one war to another. Nature's motions are measured by the seasons, by the centuries, and by the ages. And nature keeps on going in a strangely wonderful and faithful way. And everywhere in nature, the truths of nature are apparent. And man must live a little more in the consciousness of nature. And here in the West, we are losing that contact as day by day we fill up the earth with more and more of our own human activities. Now, there is talk about continuing increase in population explosions, and the fact that perhaps less and less of this earth's surface is going to be available for natural contemplation. But as yet there is room. And if man grows adequately, he will gradually grow until nature and his own nature become so completely identified that he will then have the roots of endurance in himself, but he doesn't have them there yet. He still has to depend upon something greater, something that has a more real or more substantial finality about it. Than what we know in our daily experiences. So in our way of life, it becomes very important that we get a naturalness as against the artificialities which we know. Now, what are the natural things that Zen recognizes in the human being? Zen recognizes the essential dignities and values of those phases of human nature which are natural. Therefore, that man truly matures in natural things. And what we call sophistication has practically nothing to do with maturity at all. Our idea of maturity, which is a gradual overwhelming of nature, has no place in Zen philosophy. What are the simple things that human beings really most enjoy and by which they are most secure in their life? One thing is, of course, that every human being needs to work. Zen is very particular about the fact that every human being must be occupied. They must be constructively occupied in some way. What we call a leisure class is a class that is wealthy enough to afford misery. Any individual who thinks in terms of leisure, thinks in terms of pain, whether he knows it or not. Leisure, actually, to the Oriental, Chinese, even the Hindu, more or less feels the same way about this. Leisure is nothing more or less than time which is set aside to purposes that are peculiarly and uniquely our own. Leisure is therefore an opportunity for a special kind of work, but never an opportunity to do nothing. So man naturally wants to work. He must work in order to be healthy. He must work in order to be tired, to digest his food, to do the various simple things which maintain mental, emotional, and physical equilibrium. The person, therefore, who is able to afford not to work must also be able to afford the doctor's bill, because he will have it, inevitably. Work is, therefore, a sign of dignity. Leisure is not. Today, we think of the person of leisure as the fortunate one, and that this is a status symbol of the greatest importance. The man who doesn't have to go to his office and can spend his day at the golf club is thereby a privileged person. Actually, this whole concept is wrong. Actually, the individual who has not experienced the privilege of labor has something to learn about the essential mystery of life. The second thing that all human beings need, second perhaps only to their work, is a certain basic companionship. We need friends. We need people with whom we can share, through whom we can express, to whom we can communicate. We need to have a few persons, at least, with whom we can indulge in a mature enjoyment of life. Therefore, true, honest, sincere friends are essential to the civilized state of man. These are not the type of friends who impose, who come to share their miseries. The true friend is the individual with whom there is communication. This communication is only possible where there are mutual interests. So after perhaps labor is communication, is sharing. We also need to give. It is tremendously important for the individual to have some responsibility or activity which claims a large part of his own life. We find our lives by giving our lives to things that we regard as more important than ourselves. Therefore, a person without a mission of some nature, without a sense of value, a sense that something or someone is better because they live, a person lacking this lacks most of the value of an important life. Then a life must have beauty. A life must have its participation in the dignities of value. A life must have appreciation of that which is important and true and valuable. A life must have the sense of fulfillment. And a complete and well-balanced life must be a life in which that which nature has indicated as reasonable and proper for man has been fulfilled, never evaded. Consequently, any effort to escape normal and reasonable responsibility impoverishes life. If the person lives a normal life according to nature and according to the artistry of his own consciousness, he then has written his poem, for his poem is his life. He has composed great music, for this music is his own character. And he is an artist because he has artistically used the elements of his own opportunities to build together a magnificent painting of his career, of his value, of his meaning to other people. Zen on this basis simplifies things but takes away nothing that is essentially good. It tries to help people to strip away the things that do not mean anything. And as a result of that, to have liberated time. I know that our way of life is rather more complicated than theirs, and that even if we have time, we do not always know what to do with it. It doesn't seem that we can go out and do these simple natural things that might make time otherwise a very pleasant and wonderful opportunity. But you cannot stop a man from growing if he's determined to grow. You cannot put so many obstacles in his way that he cannot improve himself if this is his determination. Therefore, if growth doesn't mean that we can do some of these things as directly and literally as might have been possible in the bamboo grove, it is still essential that we do develop a sense of internal moral artistry. And wherever we simplify life, we bring in value. We bring in improvement of self. We increase knowledge. We increase education. We share. We have more time for our children. We do things together more. We have also greater time for quiet meditation on these things which are meaningful and important to us. So by the gradual simplification of things, by the rejection of that which is meaningless, by the gradual conservation of energy, we may get even to the condition of the Taoist monk, who has found that by utter conservation of resource, he has almost lost the power to die. Because actually, a large part of death is tension. There is no reason why the person of today cannot have a longer life than he normally expects to. Obviously, it cannot always be done immediately, and there is no individual who can be certain in our way of life of the extent of years that may be ahead of him. But it is true that all other things being equal, the person who is integrated has the greatest probability of escaping those life-shortening factors which burden so many people. There may be things he cannot escape. It is not necessarily the final proof of virtue that we live to be 120 years old. After all, we're not living in the quiet, helpful atmosphere of the Diamond Mountains of Korea, where, with the exception of a little political smoke that goes way over the top and is seldom known by any of the natives, the country is still a country of magnificent natural resources. There is no smog as we know it. There is no adulterated foods. There are none of the things that may have a tendency to shorten life. But all other things being equal, with the adulteration and the smog, the facts are that as we simplify life, we save energy. We therefore have a little more energy with which to fight the smog. And other things also being equal, we may add another year or two to what might otherwise be a rather short existence. So Zen tells us that by the Zen technique, for example, that we reduce the probabilities of sickness. By the Zen simplification of consciousness, we reduce the probabilities of senility, which are always possibilities that loom a little bit difficult on the horizons of the aged. The individual's faculties are not as likely to gradually fail. If this life has been more quietly integrated, if certain impairments or limitations do arise, they are carried with greater dignity. The individual finds that the things that break other people's hearts do not break his, because he has a different level of values. You take from a person of strong material attachments the few things to which he is attached, you take these from him, he is miserable. But if the individual is attached only to universal values, it's hard to take them from him. If he is attached only to principles which are eternal, it is hard for these ever to disappoint him or disillusion him. Therefore, he is free from a great many of these tensions and stresses and enjoys instead a greater sense of internal well-being. Out of all of these considerations together comes a certain artistry. And this is the kind of artistry that I think was recognized by the critic in the study of Sesshu. The great artist is the person who has the artistic skill to create a great life. And a great life is a simple life lived with depths. And almost inevitably, the simple life produces a certain amount of actual artistry. The moment we begin to overcome the confusion in our own natures, we do discover that we are artistic people and capable of creative artistry. Japan, with a population of some 90 million people, Zen has taken over a very large part of the conscious life of these people, and also it has done a great deal of the same in China and Korea. And the result is that an amazing percentage of the people will be found to be innately artistic. You will find that the most common shopkeeper can arrange his goods in a most masterfully aesthetic manner. And when you visit a small Japanese community and get away from the hustle and bustle of some place like Tokyo, which has outgrown all reasonable proportions, but get back among the people, you will find that it is very hard to get a dinner served to you without artistry. That a plate is artistic. That they can't put salad on it without making an artistic design out of the salad. They just can't help it. And the farmer has built an artistic house without an architect. And the best architects we have go over there and copy it. And he built it one night or started it one day without a ground plan. He just sort of let it accumulate. And when it got through accumulating, it was a masterpiece. And we go over and copy it. Simply because these people, living with a certain attitude toward life, almost everything they touch reflects that attitude. I've seen the simple utensils in a Japanese kitchen that were carved by the man of the house out of nearby wood, the most simple things imaginable, and they're beautiful. We find the same artistry among many primitive peoples. We find the same artistry in Africa and in many remote parts of Asia and Polynesia, where the simple life produces a great artistic skill. Zen has done this, perhaps with a little more maturity than these other people have experienced, but the same general principle. It is hard not to dress tastefully. It is hard not to look well. If you have a certain sense of beauty in yourself, and this sense of beauty comes from a gradually enriching appreciation of value, in which little by little you become so thoughtful of the things you do that every action is practically a work of art. The artistry arising from this is extremely naive. These people are not even aware of it. It is simply Zen working in them. Zen giving them a certain simple directness of action, which has all the charm of nature's own way of doing things. And because we naturally like things to be attractive and charming and beautiful, of our own accord we would make them that way. And by means of simplifying life, we have greater opportunity to act according to our own accord. When we are under tremendous stress and strain, we cannot be ourselves. Simplify life and more of ourselves will show through. And this showing through of self will almost certainly be an improvement. It will be a greater sense of value. We will have more charm, more appeal to other people. We will have greater, even material success in life. Because the things that we do will be done graciously, charmingly, pleasantly, and cheerfully. These values come from Zen, in these people at least. Now, other causes can produce them also. But there are very few places in the world where these principles have been so scientifically studied, so completely analyzed, and made so directly into an active philosophy of conduct. And for that reason, I think our study of this subject over the next four evenings will add something to this general picture. And now I think our time is pretty well up, so we'll let you go home now and work with the knickknacks for a while.